We'll call CNRA meeting to order at 8:08 approximately. Here today are Co-Chair Olson.
Representative Olson.
Representative Sisson and Representative Newman. We're going to do the confirmation of Commissioner William Bill Knoll first, and then we'll do the fluoride bill after. So at this time, we'll call Commissioner Knoll to the chair. State your name, and what we'd like to hear from you is your background, your resume, and tell us why you want the job, or why you're doing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Bill Knoll. That's N-O-L-L, spelled like the former Pittsburgh student coach that has nothing to do with Sunday's game. I am looking forward to the outcome, for sure. I am from New York City, originally. I was raised there and came to Alaska in 1968 with the U.S. Army, like a lot of other people brought by the service or by the oil companies and so on. And to my surprise, being a guy from the city, I loved it here. So I stayed, and I've been here ever since. It's a long time between now and then, so I'll spare you the agony of a complete description of what I've done. But in general, I did the work of the pipeline, which is something I was sort of proud of, being involved in the building of this great structure, megastructure. But the majority of my private career was in developing coal exports. That is from Yosemite Coal Mine down the Alaska Railroad, building a big coal terminal at Seward, and then exporting our sub-bituminous coal to the Far East. That's a project that exists to this day, although not in its original form. It's a great industry. And in fact, today, coal is knocking at our door as a possible bridge to the future till we do hydrogen or some other energy form because of high oil and gas prices. Coal is not that high. So I think it's a kind of good background. Along with that, I had a public career living in Seward. I was eventually elected to the city council a couple of times, mayor once. Some of the most enjoyable days of my life, actually. My joking remark was that as mayor, you got paid $300 a month and all the abuse you could take. You all are involved in public services as well, and you know the fun of a midnight phone call regarding a pothole in front of somebody's house. But it's a great way, in fact, maybe the only great way, of getting in touch with people, which is where it's at as far as I'm concerned, developing jobs, developing health care units, taking care of community needs, and so on. It was a great privilege. I have a little bit of experience both in commercial fishing, where I was an investor, a minority investor in several boats. I am no longer an owner of anything in the fishing area, but a great deal of experience. I owned and operated a small tourism business for 6 or 7 years. I no longer own that as well. I am in not the beginning of my life, but rather in the richness of my life, if you will, in terms of experience. We have about 500 people in the department. I have enjoyed every day that I've been there in terms of being able to mentor what I feel is a very, very competent labor force within the state government. That's a bit about background. I've already decided whether I'm going to stay in Alaska or not 37 years ago, and I am looking forward to this assignment. I've enjoyed every minute of it. The challenges are there, but I think also the opportunities. Can I pause there before I go on and on and on to see if there might be any questions?
Sure. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. Bill, we've talked a lot about trying to save some money in this state. We've also talked, or we've heard the governor mention that the state wants to hire quite a few more personnel. Do you have an intent to hire more personnel into your department? Who would they be? How much would that cost? Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, sir. I think we have 12 new hires proposed in this budget. Each of them is accompanied by federal funds, either completely or in the vast majority. For example, at Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation, Pat Ladner is proposing 8 new hires. They would be completely paid for by federal funds.
And 4 wouldn't? Excuse me.
No, just a real quick question in regards to that. The other day, somebody was talking about when we get general fund money, and the federal funds, excuse me. The question was, who pays for the retirement? Does that come under the grant? And we, is that in there, or does the state have to pick up the retirement?
Yeah, those people, as a matter of fact, Mr. Chair, are under the state PERS system, so eventually we do, in fact, pick up the, but they would be Tier 4, so it would be a different kind of a.
Okay.
Different kind of a.
Representative Newman, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to have to refer to my directory sitting right in back of me. We have two people proposed for RUBA. They are, I think it's a 3-to-1 split in terms of federal versus state on those two new people. And they're for village safe water type programs, which is, again, community oriented. And the other two, Sam?
The one is RCA.
Oh, the RCA, right. These are RCA.
And, one is
and they're also federal.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Bill, then, so I'm to understand the 12 personnel, 8 of them are fully federally funded, and at least 3 of them, or 2 of them, are 3-to-1 funding federal to state, and then 2 100% state?
No, 2 are also accompanied by federal funds. I can't give you the ratio of this as I'm sitting here, but I can get it back to you, Representative Newman.
Quick comment?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, I commend you for going out and looking at places where we can, if we do need to increase the personnel in the state, that you are trying to go out and get some federal help on that. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Bill, I think you have a hint of kind of why I'm on this committee, and it's because of my pride of being one of the every man, woman, and child in Alaska, being part of the biggest structure, the largest structure, largest economic structure in terms of how it impacts people, and that's the health system throughout Alaska. And it's private, public. It's a myriad of service delivery and units. I mean, we're talking about units. And it is number one employer in the state. So in terms of jobs, and probably, I don't know if this is true, but I think perhaps your department could find this out, and that is possibly one of the largest underfilled positions that are already open, because there are numerous, I believe, openings in rural Alaska in health. So in other words, workforce development, trying to fill those is a kind of a huge piece to really maximize the economic part of that. I believe the system is an economic force. And I'm hopeful that you have thought of that, and if you haven't, could you work on that, because I think it's a huge thing for the state.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Sista. Healthcare, in my view, and I think it's shared by many. Healthcare is so untended in America. This is not just an Alaskan problem, nor is it just a rural Alaska problem. It is, we want people to live, but we don't want them to get old, in a sense. We want people to, it's a funny kind of a thing going on. And I am for sure not going to be taking a shot at the Bush administration nor the previous administrations. This is a program that has been growing for, since World War II, if you will, in terms of the growth. So before I get too wound up, yes, we are very interested in healthcare from one or two or three perspectives. I wish I had the numbers right in front of me. I did for 2003-2004, the state of Alaska had 8,900 new jobs, of which more than half were in the health area. New jobs, private sector jobs. The new numbers going through 2005 are 13,200 new jobs. I don't have the exact percentage breakdown, but again, the growth in health is there, big one. So it's a big one for us. How to address health needs, not only in rural Alaska, but in urban Alaska, is a huge challenge. I am very, very interested in that subject as a former mayor, as just a human being, as a commissioner of commerce and a community and economic development. I don't have any surefire answers. I know the issue is huge.
Thank you.
I'd be glad to work with you, by the way, or any member of the committee or legislature in productive ways. The Valley, the presence of the new hospital in the Valley, for example, terrific. We have met recently, I'm sorry, I'm going to maybe over-answer this, but it's a great opportunity. Billy Bob Allen and myself met, along with his staff, in my office in Anchorage. Well, what about a training facility at the old hospital in Palmer? It's a great idea. That is a kind of economic development that's right there at our fingertips, and we just have to push the button to make it happen. I think it's a 40-bed or so facility, something like that, and a tremendous training grounds. I come from Seward, where 60 people worked at Avtec. Well, it's a state function, and therefore a cost in a certain sense, but the productivity you get out of an Avtec is almost incalculable. People learning everything from how to type to celestial navigation to EMT to refrigeration repair, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that opportunity is there. I am afraid what is not accounted for yet, America-wide, is the cost involved. Can we afford the design, if you will, or the concept we have unwittingly, intentionally or unwittingly, on care of people at the prices? I just had a medical checkup yesterday. I'm okay.
Good. One more year, right?
All appearances to the contrary. It looks like I'm going to make it. But a simple medical check of $812. There you go.
Well, I hope you didn't do it because of us. So.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Knoll, quick comment. If I could do anything to help you, assist you, and any plans that you may have with the hospital in Palmer, maybe through the University of Alaska, through their nursing program and training, I'd be glad to. My question is, do you contract? It's a question that came out of education or public safety, and it's just as pertinent here, I think. Do you contract any services out to the state of Washington?
I hate to say no, because there's bound to be something in our budget. I'm thinking in the fishing area, we have about half the fleet, as you probably know, in commercial fishing resides down there. It's just a historic event. It happened as America moved westward. We have an ASME function, as you know, that falls generally within our department, and we have offices there in Ballard. We did successfully move them from Bellevue to Ballard during this administration. Someone discovered that most of the fishing took place over in Ballard and not in Bellevue, as it turns out. So
not in King County?
Actually, it is.
It's all in King.
So I'd have to say we have a considerable force represented, at least through ASME. If there's a further point to your question, I'd be glad to pursue it. Seriously.
I'd like to know.
That's good.
I am concerned about that, and maybe if you could look into what you are spending there and maybe suggest that we do what we can to try and keep as much as we can in-house. Thank you, sir.
Look at the ferry system there as well. I had some people in the office talking about looking at Washington and looking at the native tribal systems there as a potential to do business with, and took that quite seriously.
Maybe I can follow up on that one also. The other day, after reading my co-chair's resolution to my right, they were talking about where would you locate a new terminal in the state of Washington, and the governor had heard about the resolution, and he looked at me, and where would you put it? I says, Lummi Reservation, just north of Bellingham, about 6 miles, and you build your own terminal there, and you have no alliance then to the state of Washington, and we get a cut of their casino and their hotel room. And I mean, we make money on this thing.
Absolutely.
So, and you really don't lay off anybody. You're just going to Lummi. So,
but I did.
An alternative outside the state of Washington.
Mr. Chair, I think that's the context exactly that was brought up in my office as well.
Right.
Worked for me.
This guy here, yeah.
I've been out at the clinic.
Questions?
No questions.
I have one that, in your, on the summary we have, or brief summary you have here, said you were a member of the four-man fish cabinet, which managed a large segment of the successful wild fish marketing effort. What did they do? Are they, is that where you went out, get federal funds to help relieve the...
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The very interesting, very eventful amount of about $50 million we inherited from Senator Frank Murkowski, Ted Stevens, and Don Young. So when the governor took office, we had this pot of money and what to do. And there were some thoughts about what to do. We scrapped those and pulled together four quite experienced people, actually, to try to allocate that money. They were Alan Osterman, who was the newly appointed senior fish advisor, myself, acting on behalf of Edgar. Edgar Blatchford asked me to sit on it. Greg O'Clary, from the labor point of view, and, of course, ADF&G, Kevin Duffy and Dave Bedford. So our first order of business was to allocate that $50 million. What are you going to do with it? We put money into marketing. We put money into capital grants, that is, upgrading the kind of fish processing we did. We did some dead giveaway, if you will, and we put about $5 million, allocated that toward beleaguered fisher people. I know that probably everybody in the room is touched by the fishing industry somehow. I was, and I know you are. We particularly found, we used a income tax return kind of approach, found people who just really hadn't made it, had really been crippled by the downturn in the fishing industry. Put about $5 million out in direct payments. They were about $1,100 apiece, as memory serves, and went out in July of 2003. We took another $7 million and did the same kind of thing for communities whose tax receipts, we were talking about earlier, had been hit by either no fish sales or very low fish sales, low when the price went from $2 to 20 cents, you lose revenue. So that accounted for about $12 million of that 50. We then went into a little bit here for research, a little bit there for university, but the vast majority, about $30 million, half of it toward marketing and half of it toward capital grants. They were matching money approaches. And that came straight from Governor Murkowski's suggestion, by the way, and I think it was a good one, where we received applications for use of the money through public announcements, but in every case, you had to show up and bring some money with you. So if you had a $100,000 request, we'll split it with you if you're a private sector person. You put up 50, we'll put up 50. And we tapered that for public entities in terms of the, of say, a 501c3 or a municipality. We did a 2-to-1 split. They put up a dollar, we put up two, which was helpful for public infrastructure type of projects or ice plants and cold storage and so on that was we saw as very eventful down here in southeast or out west. Long answer, but I think that's been without doubt one of the most successful programs of the past 3 years. I wish Mark Edwards were here. He keeps the numbers around our house. He's an economist. In 2005, exports, I'm sorry, 2004, exports alone of seafood products out of Alaska was $1.7 billion. It'll be $2 billion in 2005. So huge leaps, like quantum leaps, in terms of the kind of money that's coming into our system. To put that in perspective, 1998, that number was around $700 million. It was a huge jump. Well, where did that come from? We like to think that it came from a number of things. Some of it was applied allocation of money, better fishing techniques. We had a bit of luck in terms of suddenly people on the East Coast or in Europe discovering, you know what, they put additives in that farm fish to make it come out that color. Do I really want to eat those additives? And we didn't pay for a dime of that. It simply sprang out on the pages of health magazines and newscasts and New York Times and so on. And we've got anecdote after anecdote. I was back to some kind of conference in D.C. The cab driver was a Korean War veteran. In Sunday morning, where are you going, buddy? It's always the kind of thing. Going to Alaska. Oh, you know, that salmon, omega-3, it's really good for you. Unbelievable penetration of this concept. And as me, among others, are the people delivering that, who were taking advantage of that natural trend that started to blossom over the past couple of years And we're reinforcing that, yes. It is Alaska salmon, it is wild, and no, we don't have any additives, and so on. We're very happy with this program. As I look forward to 2006, we are not letting the hand off the throttle on that program. We do have money left. Most recently, you may know, we put $1 million on the street for small vessel upgrades. $25,000 max, again, one-for-one match, and we sold out immediately. So we're kind of scrambling amongst ourselves to see if we can't put another $500,000 or another million into it. We had over 90 as
134.
Hmm? 134. You're keeping track. Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, we're very happy with it.
And it was, Commissioner, the reason I know I had some fishermen in yesterday that in Wrangell that helped open the, they have the Alaska Wild, you know, Rainforest Wild, and they had fishermen who were struggling trying to keep their boats upgraded because of the demise of the salmon industry. So they opened their office up and pulled down your computer and did all the application and loan applications for their fleet down there. And so they were here the other day and they found out it was 134 applications. And I think they did run out of money, but they averaged only $5,000 to $6,000 for their gillnet fleet. But you could have borrowed a match one-to-one, $1 to their one. But that's a good program.
We started getting, if I may say, from people, oh, you ran out of money. And I email back and tell my staff, don't, you know, just apply. And we'll scramble and try to find someone.
One of the, how would I put this? I sit with a tribal government in a community of Haines. Worst thing a fisherman likes to do is sit there and do paperwork. And I was trying to get a block grant and then had, you know, helped the fishermen that way and still do the same. If we applied for $50,000, they'd have to match it, but they wouldn't allow labor, you know, if they do their own labor. They said that's not part of it. They had to have materials in there, and I said, well, you know, you have to have somebody. When you work with fiberglass and resin and on a boat, it's pretty nasty. It costs you $25 an hour to have somebody go down in there. And so they wouldn't use labor as a match, but you could pay somebody else. And this is what my staff had found out. You couldn't match it. I thought you should be allowed to, if you're going to do the labor, allow them a $25 an hour wage to it. So you might, when you look at it again, I think it's a good way. And then you know that if they do a bad job, it's your fault. But I wanted a block grant, and then we got like 55 gallons of resin and so much insulation and so much roving and, you know, fiberglass matting, and let the fishermen do their own work. You know, it's a little bit of pride when you work on your own boat. So, but there that's is, a good program.
There is indeed. And see if I got the problem straight for me. So a person who owns a boat puts in for a $10,000 grant, for example, of which $8,000 is materials and $2,000 is overhead for his own time, that kind of a thing.
Yeah,
and it was disallowed.
But it was not allowed.
It was not
allowed. Labor's not allowed.
We're looking
it had
into
to
that.
Be.
That's,
yeah, it had
that's
to be materials only. And,
question.
And so if you have no money to pay for it in any way, you know, somehow, some way, somebody has to put that in there.
So it wouldn't apply to the match.
Right. And, you know, so if I did it, it's above it and beyond it. It's still a good program, but I think they should be allowed. You know, we have, just speaking at the local level, you know, we had, it was the state's third largest year last year, and it's probably the lowest average income for at least for Haines. You know, then it was the third largest year for the fishing industry in Alaska. And I went to the Ocean Beauty Dinner, and the plant manager who was from Excursion Inlet told me that. And he said it was the worst year he'd ever seen for Lincolnell and Taku. And yet it was a boomer year statewide. And so I represent the fishermen out of Haines, so I need to, you know, look at them. But I want to compliment you on the whole program that you had for training people, and I know, I think it came out of the Department of Labor, but if you worked on it, it was a great deal. I think we had about 30 young men, boys out of Craig, Kluak, the Prince of Wales Island, that went to the East Coast for to become a crew member. What do they call this? Merchant Marine School. And two or three of them came through here when the oil tanker came through, and they were on board there, so they were sent off and trained in Maryland or someplace, and Exxon hired them, and they were on the ship when they came through here. So that worked out very well, and we got lots of compliments about that program. And I think it's ceasing, or because the industry now is on the uprise and making more money, but we just want to compliment you for that. Was part of your idea. That was a good one.
Thank you. I speak almost on a daily basis with Greg O'Clery.
Yeah.
And the governor is right on board with this idea, myself, Greg, in terms of making opportunities for young people here.
Well, it makes a difference.
It makes a big difference.
The one young man that comes out of Haines, he was a tenderman for 3 years with us, and he went from making $20,000 a year to about $70,000, and he's off and on, and they fly him all the way from L.A. back to Haines, and he's getting a little bigger, and I says, you know, it must feed you good. He says, oh, prime rib, lobster, the works. And, you know, he's on that big oil tanker, and he said, you couldn't find a better job.
Good food.
And he didn't smoke either, so he said that was even better. But that was a great, great project.
And that's about this mug on oil tanker. That's comforting. That's good.
Yeah. Now my favorite topic, Mr. Commissioner.
Sir.
LBC. We have dealt with them time after time, and I've been telling people, and I've been at different committees now, and I'm starting to catch on why some of these departments never go in the direction of the legislature wants it, because next year some of us won't be here, and we don't have consistency as much as the departments do. And so we'll tell them, this year this is what we want, yeah, we'll do it, we're getting on it right now, then next year they'll go back to the same ideas and same feelings they had before. But LBC, we've been hammering on last year, a little bit more this year, and being pretty ruthless, actually, because the complaints we're getting about, we always thought that you want to maximize your boundaries for a municipality, and then they're shrinking them, where they come back and they're getting 25%. And I think there are some rules in there that we thought they were implementing that we didn't think they should have. And there's some, there were a flurry of bills last year, and I think they're all might be stuck on the other side, that we're trying to redirect LBC. We have an incentive bill to form boroughs, and when Dan was here, I told him, you have the chance to be a hero or not, but after that was different words, because he can either allow the borough boundaries as people draw them or shrink them to a point where they may not go forward. And it's important in the bill, I can't remember the Senate bill number, for the administrative borough bill, which you've been looking at, keeping the incentives in there for
248.
Yeah, okay, for the community, especially in southeast and even up north where they don't have any federal land. For your information, and talking to Senator Lyman Hoffman, mm-hmm. he said there's no reason for us to form, there's no state land in my district. But then after he told me you get a $15 million grant with that, and then PILT goes with you, he was under the understanding that PILT would go and stay with the state. He says they might be able to make it if you get payment in lieu of taxes that goes to municipalities plus the grant. And so I know as of, and I was talking with Sally, as of this week, there's been at least four different borough conversations going on, three in southeast and one from the interior now, looking at, but they're all falling back to those incentives. I think without the incentive language in there, they're going to have a real hard time trying to move forward. So I'd like to know where you stand with the incentives, and I believe you'll have people testifying, I'm sure, on that bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you can count on my 110% support on that bill and on incentives. This is an age-old thought on my part in terms of how America in general works, and that it's with the land. Mark Twain said it, or some of the famous philosophers, they ain't making any more of it.
Right.
Getting land, getting this power, this opportunity down, again, as a former mayor, down to a local level is paramount in having some progress, creating opportunities for local people. So however it's done, whether it's done under the original thought at statehood or whatever you will, I think this admin borough bill, and I think you and Gary Stevens or Senator Stevens are to be commended for the work you did this during the interim. It's a terrific idea. It's a step forward, and I'm very supportive.
Right. My understanding, at least the way I see it, is you form an admin borough to make your land grab and establish your boundaries.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And if as the language wasn't quite clear, but we're going to watch it as it goes through. if LBC denies your land grab or your boundaries, then I've been telling people, I want to make sure I put language in there, you have the option to dissolve or pop out of the administrative boroughs and not go forward. And that's where we've been telling Dan, you can become the hero, or you can be the one that destroys the idea of boroughs going forward. As I explained to Sally in our teleconference the other day, we sent maps out to communities and suggesting where they would go with their borough boundaries and take up, because there were some voids even under the model borough boundaries in southeast, under the plan that I was drawing up for them, there are no more, you know, empty donut holes there in southeast. But this is, I think, is a great chance to go forward with what people, and just to, for your info, you probably heard Senator Stu Jaluski talking that the incentives are the only way to go now, because there is no land. And one of the, just for your info, and I've told Sally again, is in the two boroughs that they're looking at merging, the Chatham and the Glacier Bay borough, the total land that they would get, I believe, is 381, or it's less than 400 acres, because it was all federal land, and what state land was there, the university took out, and so we have the option to buy that back, and that's why it's key, again, for the incentive money, they can buy some land back if they need to. Hopefully, after the public record is done, would tell me you live with that money. You don't go splurge on that thing and file for bankruptcy later. But
I couldn't agree more, and I know several of those commissioners, and Dan doesn't operate in a vacuum, as you well know, Dan Bockhorst. He works for commissioners, and some very smart people, very good people on board there. But I'll talk to the likes of Bob Hicks, who lives in Seward, by the way, Tony Nakazawa and Darrell and so on, and how their feelings are regarding this subject to talk about boundaries. I would be surprised if they were not anything but supportive.
Good.
General progress is being made with that bill. I like it very much.
Right, and the key thing is it's a four-year incentive. After 4 years, if you don't form a borough, that incentive is gone. And I think that's very key. It kind of like holds your feet to the fire. Mm-hmm. You look at it, either you're going to jump or you don't. And we know that the process takes a while. They can form. I mean, draw their mark here real quick, like, but then the process of getting there takes a little longer. So, any questions, Representative Newman?
Thank you, Representative Thomas, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Knoll, as Representative Thomas implied a little bit, you know, with the local boundary commission, we've tried to give a little bit of direction to them or some of our insight of, because of our connection and talks that we have with our constituents, of some of the problems that they've gone through. What connection do you have with the local boundary commission? Do you have any oversight, or are you part of that? Or
thank you, through the chair, Representative Newman. The department provides administrative support, structural support, if you will, for the commission. The commission is a separately appointed authority under the Constitution, and acts independently, if you will, which is a good thing, I think. We at the department have a small staff. I think we're comprised of three people at the moment that help them with their minutes and the scheduling and the notices and so on, and any research that they feel required. That is not to underplay what the department does. The department does a lot. It's a full-time job and more. You find those people in at night and weekends very frequently.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any more questions? Wishes of the committee?
May I take a motion to move this on to the floor?
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Okay, hearing no objections, your name will be moved forward to the vote of the House. Then thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Anybody has to get up this early should be commended. So.
For the coffee.
Yes, yeah, so for the coffee. Is he coming?
He's coming.
Brief at ease.
Yeah, take a brief at ease here. Call the CNRA meeting back to order. At this time, we have Representative Seaton here to present HCR 5, and at this time, we'll have the sponsor brief us with his resolution. Good morning, Mr. Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. It's a pleasure to be here. What this
resolution addresses is supporting community water fluoridation. As you can see from the whereases and the resolution itself, it's hugely important to the health of Alaskans, not only their dental health, but their long-term physical health. And we have just in the last couple of years came through with a senior dental care program for exactly the same reason, that not taking care of teeth has long-term and massive health costs associated with it. As you'll see in there, 100% of Alaska cities over 330,000 population have fluoridated water. You know, fluoridation has been recognized by the Department of Health Health and Human Services and many other organizations as being a very effective way to help with dental disease. And so what this resolution does is it just signifies that the Alaska legislature recognizes the benefits of community water fluoridation, and also it requires that all new village safe water projects have fluoridation mechanisms incorporated, or not the mechanisms, but that are just designed so that they can take fluoridation if the local community decides that it wants to fluoridate. This is not a requirement for fluoridation. It is totally for communities to be able to fluoridate. But if we design a facility and build it without fluoridation access valves, in a space for the chemical barrel that would need to be in there, what happens is you have to redesign the facility, which includes a large amount of cost, instead of just coming in with the equipment and making the connections. And so that's the two things this does, is make sure that the facilities that we fund have the ability to easily take fluoridation, and that we are recognizing and letting the communities know that there is a great medical benefit. You'll see in the letters of support, you had many of them, like the State Medical Association and Public Health Association, but I've just recently got to you a letter from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. There's local Community Health Service, Southeast Regional Health Consortium, Alaska Environmental Health Association, Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, American Academy of Pediatrics, Alaska Nurses Association, City of Port Lyons, Bristol Bay Health Corporation, and various dentists that have been included with your packet today. So with that, I would like to introduce my staff, Katie Schaus, if you have detailed questions, as well as we have two experts here, Troy Ritter, who's the Senior Environmental Health Specialist, and also Brad Whistler, who's a dental officer with Department of Health and Social Services.
Questions? Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that that I'm interested in is the economics part of this. And in my early years working on a degree, took me years to get, one of my minors was anthropology. And studies done on Aborigines in Australia had lifespan linked to presence of teeth. So the teeth in the body are really one of the real indicators. And just this fall was out in the Aleutians, and what the clinics were talking about there was one of the largest reasons for medevacs were dental emergencies. The dental emergencies were huge amount. And I'm wondering if you've got any studies, if you've run across any studies of dental costs or costs of not taking care of teeth. And fluoride's a big one.
Yeah, Representative Sisson, through the chair. Yes, we have some a number of studies here, and one of the figures is for every dollar spent on fluoridation, it saves approximately $37 in medical costs. And those technical questions, I'd hope you, we have Brad Whistler, who's a medical officer, a dental officer with DHSS.
Okay.
So if I could turn the rest of the testimony over to my staff and the two people that I've brought to testify to appreciate, because I'm chairing another committee right now.
Nope.
Can I? One quick one, Representative. Have you encountered any opposition to this?
There's a few letters in here, and I believe the professional staff here will talk to those, but very little, very little.
Minimal.
Yes, minimal opposition, and you, any opposition that we have, you have in your packet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're excused. Any other questions? You had your hand, no? Representative Sisno?
Well, in following up the question that I asked Representative Seaton, are you the person I should ask about economic studies on dental?
For the record, my name is Katie Shaw, staff to Representative Seaton. I would like to call Troy Ritter, the Senior Environmental Health Specialist for ANTHC, to talk about the economic impact and the system, the water fluoridation systems.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'll try to address that question.
Your name and
my name is Troy Ritter. I'm the Senior Environmental Health Consultant for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And as to the question, my expertise really is about the cost of implementing the fluoride itself, which we say are in the neighborhood of $1 per person per year. Now, I'm not such an expert on the cost of medical dental treatment, but I can say that that $1 per person per year, for most communities, we can fluoridate the entire community for a year for about what it would cost to fill one cavity. So that's a pretty good return. Also, you know, there, in terms of public health interventions, there are very few of those that actually save more money than they cost. But fluoride is one of those ones that does bring about more cost savings than you spend initiating it.
Great.
Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ritter, I'm a little bit familiar with chlorinated water systems and how they work. With the fluoridation, is that just a simple injection system?
It's actually
really minimal as far as putting in the infrastructure that's needed to make it available. It's very minimal, isn't it?
It's very minimal. And actually, the injection equipment, the delivery system, is very similar to chlorine. You have a little bit different type of injection system, but it's really just a different type of pump. It's the same basic design, though. And the barrel has a different chemical in it, but it is basically the same type of system. Actually, fluoride, from an operation, a maintenance standpoint, is easier to deliver than chlorine, because fluoride is chemically stable, so the levels you put in don't change. You don't have to worry about that variance, whereas chlorine dissipates and you have to constantly monitor that.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, too, just for my own. With the chlorine, you know, that's extremely dangerous to handle when you're putting it in there. You should have oxygen supplied and the whole works. Is fluorine, is there any dangers connected to that as far as the maintenance personnel that have to make sure that the bottles are changed out and the injection system, lead washers? Is there a danger connected to fluorine?
Well, the type of fluoride that's injected here is a powder form known as sodium fluoride, and you know there's the basic principle of toxicology says it's the dose that makes the poison, and there's no doubt that an operator who is, say, handling those bags, we recommend they use a regular respirator, which they are all supplied with. It's more of a dust mask type of respirator rather than a supplied air, because you know, we don't want them taking unnecessary risks. But on the other hand, that can be handled extremely safely, and we sure haven't experienced any types of problems like that with our operators in handling it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is kind of a follow-up on my earlier question, because I keep on thinking about the fact that if we tend not to think about kind of the money part on a lot of the things, and yet we can't build the state without that. And I know that there is a big dollar amount on dental, lack of attention.
Yeah.
And if it's possible in your kind of working on this stuff to, if you run into things that you could share with this committee, that would kind of point us in the direction of the total cost of not taking care of some of these things, I think it'd be very useful to get.
Yeah. I can say that, from the best evidence and studies that are out there, as well as our Alaskan-specific observations, I think that fluoridated communities probably reduce their dental disease by about 40%. What I'm not aware of is what the total cost of delivering dental services to that community would be, but I would expect that you would reduce it by about that much.
40%. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Hearing none, we have a whole, just three people offline, we'll bring them in. Do you have any other comments you wish to make while you're here? Because we're going to call you back up.
Well, I do have a prepared general statement. I'd be glad to offer that now, or I can sure wait.
Well, either way, you're there right now if you want to give it, and then we'll go offline and get the three people here and come back.
Great. I can wrap this up quickly.
Sure.
First of all, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak on the important subject. I've worked within Alaska's tribal health system for the last approximately 7 years. I've served as Chief Environmental Health Officer for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel, on an interim basis as Environmental Health Manager for the Manilik Association in Kotzebue, and currently at my present position with ANTHC. ANTHC is the largest tribally managed health organization in the United States, and we work with our partners to deliver comprehensive health services. And I think that's important because we're not just focused on dental care. We also do things like cancer prevention and treatment and things like that. My role within ANTHC is pretty simple. I'm responsible for making sure that my division's activities provide maximum health benefit. And with that said, I'm here to say that this is something that we strongly support. We see many benefits, but particularly I have 3 points I want to make. First of all, we appreciate the HCR5 resolution for what it is not, in that it does not require communities to fluoridate their water system. Even though many states have similar requirements, this resolution puts that choice in the hands of the community, which we feel is important. Secondly, we feel like this would help align state, tribal, and federal efforts around this issue. The tribal and federal side already have formal policies which contain language very similar to what's in this resolution. We get some excellent cooperation from our state and federal partners, but an opportunity to provide a more streamlined service delivery is always available. So we think that would be a benefit. And lastly, fluoridation has sometimes been a subject where there's been misunderstanding and misinformation. It's clear to me that within the mainstream health and public health communities, there is no controversy about this issue. And I think that passage of this resolution would allow us to say that as a state, we rely on credible, science-based information when making our health decisions. To wrap things up, not everyone agrees on fluoridation. I think there is a very small percentage of people who do disagree. But what I hope we can all agree on is that those communities that make the decision to fluoridate, we owe them our best efforts to keep them healthy and safe. And this resolution would no doubt increase our ability to do that. A lot of times, public health service delivery is a game of trade-offs in that when you do something to improve one area, you could affect another. What we like about this is that we consider it an all-win type situation. This would give our public health professionals a tool that they can use to create safer, healthier communities without negatively impacting any other area, as we can see. And that's why we support this. We hope you will as well.
Okay, thank you. This time we'll go off net here to Fairbanks LIO to Arthur Hansen, are you there? Give your name and affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. Hansen. I'm a retired dentist. I have worked in the villages, and I support this bill wholeheartedly. If we can reduce the decay or any dental problems in the villages, this is the least expensive way of doing that. And enabling the villages to do what they need to do with fluoridation, I think, is the way to do it. And I wholeheartedly support this. Captain Ritter stated the reasons for doing it and the cooperation that this bill engenders. And I just want to say I support it. I have in practice now. I retired in 84. But having gone to the villages and seeing what's there, anything that we can do to help anyone prevent decay or any other dental problems is what we need to do. And that's really all I have to say, but I encourage you to support this.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, thank you. And we'll go to Homer, to William Marley.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bill Marley, and I am a Homer resident and a constituent of Representative Paul Seaton. And I appreciate very much him presenting this bill to the legislature. I am also the representative of the Alaska Dental Society, representing the Fluoride Committee. And I'd like to say that after 37 years of practice in Homer, I'm also a retired dentist, by the way, and after 37 years of practice, I can assure you that after each successive year, I only appreciated and respected the value of people's oral health relative to their overall well-being year after year. And the American Dental Association puts out a booklet, by the way, on fluoride facts. And they cite over 358 references on scientific studies supporting the safety and efficacy of fluoridating community water supplies. Fluoride is endorsed by the American Dental Association and, of course, the Alaska Dental Society and the Center for Disease Control, the American Medical Association, the U.S. Surgeon General, and the National Institute of Craniofacial Research, and over 100 other national and international associations dealing with water and health. Fluoride of community water supplies has been found to be both safe and effective, and studies are ongoing to confirm this safety and effectiveness all the time. Cost effectiveness, as somebody pointed out before, for every dollar invested, you get $18 in return. That's an amazing number. I'd sure like to be able to invest those kinds of monies in the stock market, by the way. And there was one study in Louisiana involving Medicaid patients that showed a 50% saving to Medicaid patients in a fluoridated community versus a non-fluoridated community. And fluoride has over 60 years of experience in our country and millions of years of natural existence. It did not come from a test tube, but from a natural existence. It was found, by the way, as a result of a study done by Colorado Springs Dental Society back in the early 1900s. And it was found to exist naturally in the southwest of the United States. In fact, sometimes there was so much fluoride in the water that rather than put it in, some of it had to be taken out to adjust for a proper level of adjustment. So fluoride in the water only duplicates what existed naturally in nature. In 1992, by the way, Alaska had 120 communities fluoridating their water. Now that has been dropped down to almost around the number of 37. I'd like to point out, by the way, that Article 7, Section 4 of the Alaska State Constitution states that the legislature shall provide for the promotion and protection of the public health. so this act would be consistent with the Constitution of the State of Alaska. I'd also like to point out that this resolution mandates nothing to the communities of Alaska, but does provide badly needed leadership. Fluoride information can be very confusing, and it can excite fear, but that that can be overcome by good leadership, and I'm asking you for this leadership. I must say that my observations of life are that fear and sex are probably the easiest things to sell in the world, and all too often those people opposed to fluoride are put in a position of fear. Alaska has many challenges, and we cannot afford not to take advantage of the opportunities that exist, such as fluoride, which is so well proven and for the health and the benefit of the people of our state. House Concurrent Resolution Number 5 presents the opportunity of every member of the legislature to be more empowered than many, many dentists. I'd really like to point that out, that your leadership could reduce the number of dentists, and your leadership and promoting people to get fluoride in our water supplies has the opportunity to prevent the need for more dentists. I saw in the newspaper yesterday that Mr. Dr. Ron Nagel said that PHS felt like they were understaffed by 25% for the number of people in the bush. But if we reduce the rate of decay from, Captain Ritter says, as much as 40%, and it might even be higher than that in the lower socioeconomic groups in our country and in Alaska, if you reduce that number of the rate of decay by, say, 40 or even some studies have shown even 60% reductions in decay, then the need for the numbers of dentists would be decreased significantly. I thank you for your time, and I hope you give this resolution all the attention and positiveness it deserves. Thank you.
Thank you. Question? Representative Newman has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I just had a real quick question, if you could just briefly touch on.
Sure.
That over 120 communities used to have fluoride, but now only 37 do. Why did they drop it? Just cost, or is it just somewhat, you feel a fear that you stated?
I can't give you the answer that that is needs to be deserved. It might be a good question to ask Dr. Whistler or Troy Ritter about, and I think they could answer that question better than myself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Jim Toole in Anchorage, are you there? Give your name and affiliation and testimony. Try to keep it fairly short if we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Toole. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Dental Society. You have just heard from two of my distinguished members of the Alaska Dental Society. And very quickly, I will try to not reiterate too much of the statistical information that's been presented by Dr. Marley. But the Alaska Dental Society unequivocally supports this resolution. We recognize that tooth decay is a chronic disease and the most common chronic disease that's found in children. Again, as Dr. Marley pointed out, fluoride is a naturally occurring element, and it has a 60-year history of proving to be the most safe and effective public health measure to prevent tooth decay and to improve overall oral health for the lifetime of an individual. Community water fluoridation is a public health measure that benefits individuals of all ages and all socioeconomic groups. The average cost of the information that I have available to me to fluoridate a community is somewhere around 50 cents per person, and the average annual cost then per person is less than one-third of an average dental restoration or the filling of a cavity. There are over 225 current peer-reviewed studies that recognize the effectiveness of community water fluoridation. as a public health benefit. And with that, I will say that we know that in 2004, Alaska spent $19.3 million on Medicaid and Denali dental care. Quick estimate, if water fluoridation were to save, let's say, do a 25% reduction in caries, that's a significant savings to the state of Alaska. And again, we're pleased to join with all the others who are supporting this resolution.
Thank you. We have one question from Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I would love to know if you got, you mentioned the cost in Alaska of, and I didn't catch whether that was overall dental costs or specific caries costs that were attributed to Denali kid care payments. Is it possible for you to supply us with maybe some references that we could have to sort of put those numbers together that I was mentioning before?
It certainly is, Representative Zestna. Again, the numbers that I have were $19.3 million. That's total for dental care, Medicaid, Denali, kid care.
Okay. Thank you.
But be more than happy to work with Dr. Whistler to get you specific answers to that question.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Shelley Hughes, your off-net name and affiliation.
Good morning. This is Shelley Hughes with Alaska Primary Care Association. I'm the policy analyst, and thank you, co-chairs Representative Olson, Representative Thomas, and members of the committee. This is going to be very brief. We would simply like to be added to the list of supporters that Representative Seaton read at the beginning of his presentation. We are in recognition of the fact that fluoridation does benefit the health of community members, and we represent 24 health organizations throughout the state and have 115 community health centers, and we believe that this would be a positive thing for the betterment of the health of Alaskans, and so we are in support of House Concurrent Resolution Number 5. Thank you.
I think Shelley wrote your name down. Or Katie, excuse me. Okay, let the record show Representative Salmon is here. This time is there anybody else off net, off site? Okay, we'll come into the committee room here into Juneau. Tom Borstein, come up and name and affiliation.
Thank you. Tom Borstein, I'm the Director of Dental Services for the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. And I would also like to be very brief, as a relief to the crowd. I just want to add our names to the list of people that support this for the above reasons given. And that's about as brief as I can be.
Questions?
Yeah. Are there any questions for me?
I have one. Yeah. One that Representative Newman kind of touched on. Why do you think the villages aren't putting fluoride in?
I can answer that, but... At
least in Southeast, to where you're at.
Well, it's a statewide issue. Okay. And there was an overfeed incident in a fluoride system in Hooper Bay in 92. I was trying to remember the date of it. And it was a very tragic event. And when the sequence of events was gone ahead and dissected, one of the issues was the adequate monitoring of the village water system. And at that time, DEC then promulgated several new regulations concerning the use of fluoride. And what happened was some of the, and I know all of you are familiar with the village health systems and village water systems, but some of the communities that were just teetering on the edge of being able to comply with the water fluoridation rules at the time could not meet the new standards. The new standards required much more stringent monitoring and much more stringent regulations to use. And so for that reason, many of the systems then went offline. And I think that, Troy could probably give you a pretty in-depth discussion of that, but that's the basic.
So it came down to cost, is what you're saying?
It came down to cost and expertise, local expertise, the availability of people to water plant operators to do the monitoring. And so that was kind
of. One other question. What happens when you overfeed a system? What happens to the people that are drinking the water? Do they get sick or they?
Yes. They, and it takes many, many, many times the recommended dose. I mean, before you'll notice an acute effect, it has to be sort of in the range of 50 times for a brief period of time. A chronic overfeed, like 2 to 3 times overfeed, would result in a kind of a long-term teeth mottled kind of thing. But, you know, in this instance, my understanding was that there was an individual who was sick, became dehydrated, drank. People told him to drink more. He drank more. He was already, you know, compromised, and he within himself ended up just kind of with, you know, 100 times the dose he should have been getting. So that was the issue there.
So there's no, is it cause cancer? Is it just cause teeth?
No.
Just dehydration, it, and you end up dying, or?
Yes, there was one death associated with it, and it's, I would say, in the, I'm not aware of other situations like that, but, you know, in the millions and millions and millions of people are on fluoridated water systems, and, you know, this is certainly a tragic event, and that's what kind of led to the increased regulations, but this is extremely rare.
Okay, you have one here first, and we represent Cisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this brings up, it's not sort of directly related to this resolution, but it really factors into all of what we do in rural Alaska, and that is that whole training component to all of the thousands, I think, of philanthropic dollars that go, well, it's probably billions, go out to all these different communities, and the training of the local people to manage what these billions of dollars are that are spent into their in their communities. And unless we somehow figure out how to have something attached to these different things that helps people to take care of, to monitor the different pieces of equipment and make that actually part of the money, so that the part, you know, you'd almost want to have something added to every resolution, to every, I mean, have you ever talked about that and thought about how we could actually make people be able to use the systems that are given to them so they really work?
Well, yes. Actually, the implementation of these systems requires a level of training and monitoring as per regulation. So it's a village can't decide that they want to fluoridate and then do it on their own without complying with the DEC regulations.
Okay. So. We do have DEC here, so.
Okay.
And
I'll add to it, but how do we add the money? Because the money is the big problem. So we're going to ask DEC.
After. We can drag her up after everybody's done.
Right.
Yeah.
Remember
Salmon?
That.
She said no, but.
The question I had is, in Fort Yukon, I noticed they start treating water here early on, probably in starting in the 70s anyway. And what happens, you see the teeth, the kids, the younger kids coming up, and they have spots on their teeth. Is that, what would that be caused from?
Well, it can be one of two reasons. If there is an overfeed of fluoride, or if a child is overexposed to fluoride, they can get some little white spots or decalcifications. They can also get white spots or decalcifications prior to getting decay. So maybe they have under fluoridate, or they're, for other reasons, they're getting decay. So you know, I'd almost have to see the specific case.
Yeah, that's, but that's, but it's not a decay. I mean, there's white spots on their teeth.
It is possible to get white spots or mottled spots from over fluoridation. So that is a possibility, but not from, it's not been demonstrated with the proper levels of fluoride.
Would that be from maybe just their own body reaction? A child next to them may not have the same problem? Is it just your resistance, maybe?
If a group of people were receiving an over fluoridated water over a long period of time, generally speaking, throughout that group, there would be kind of a mottled appearance or possibly white spots or things like that. There's never been any incidence of that in a controlled fluoridated delivery system that's delivered at the recommended dose.
So now when I see a child with the white spots, I know.
Yeah, it is possible. Okay. But I can tell you after 20-something years of delivering care in villages, occasionally I do see kids with white spots and no cavities, and I just think, what a trade-off. You know, it's a nice thing, actually.
Right. Okay, thank you. Yeah. We have a Brad Whistler.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Brad Whistler. I'm the dental officer with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. And I had some prepared comments, but I think I'll just try and touch on some of the questions that have been asked. First of all, the department is supportive of community water fluoridation. It has a long-standing history in the United States. Last year was the 60th anniversary of the first controlled studies in looking at water fluoridation in Grand Rapids, Michigan. There's over 80 years of studies, and it continues to be studied and modifications in terms of proper fluoride levels. One of the things I want to touch on is just this last comment in terms of white flecking in the enamel that's seen with high fluoride. As Tom mentioned, it's not the only thing that can cause that. One can be the start of decay in the enamel, and it remineralizes, and you get that same white, chalky sort of appearance to the tooth. In terms of fluoride, the most common reasons why we think we see this is swallowing toothpaste. If you look at water fluoridation, water typically in the United States is fluoridated at 0.7 to 1 part per million. For Alaska, the recommendation is 1 to 1.2 because we're in a colder climate and people generally drink less water. Toothpaste is about 1,000 to 1,500 parts per million. So if you see, you know, a young child that's brushing their teeth, unattended, likelihood is they're going to swallow some toothpaste. And so the recommendations with that is that in terms of young children, you should not be striping the whole length of the brush. You should be using a pea-sized or salmon egg-sized drop on the brush. And for very young children, you know, up to even 7 or 8 years old, parents should really be assisting. You know, you want to establish the habit and have the child brush their teeth, but not just unattended, to leave them alone with the toothpaste tube and what might be going on there. Just in the last year, there's also been some studies that have looked at amoxicillin, which is commonly used for treating middle ear infections, that it shows an appearance somewhat that looks like this dental fluorosis. So given that we have a lot of otitis media in Alaska, it's another possibility if that antibiotic causes discoloration of the teeth that some of that could also be causing what you're seeing in the enamel. So just, it's not that you can just sort of say if you see those white flecks that that's water fluoridation that's causing that. In terms of the studies that have looked at long-term controls, it's fairly infrequent with water fluoridation that you see that kind of pattern. In terms of costs, the one study was quoted in terms of a national model that looks for every dollar spent, it saves about $37 in treatment costs. California is a state that actually did a fluoridation mandate in terms of requiring the large urban areas in California to become fluoridated here a number of years ago. Their study showed for every dollar spent, it saved about $140. Two reasons for that. One is that they're large communities, and so the per-person cost of doing fluoridation is very low. And additionally, California has higher dental treatment costs than the national average. Alaska would probably fall somewhere in between there. We're smaller community sizes, so on a per capita basis, it's more expensive. But our treatment costs are also high. So we probably fall somewhere between that $38 in savings and $140 in savings. In terms of total dental costs in the state, I don't know of a source to estimate all costs that we spend on dental care in the state. But as Jim Toll mentioned, in the Medicaid program, in 2004 we spent about $19 million. In 2005 we spent about $20 million. In terms of fluoridation, remember that many of our large communities in Alaska already are fluoridated. So in terms of Anchorage and Juneau and Fairbanks, we have fluoridation going on there. So it's not like if you, there's the Medicaid program and others are already reaping some of that benefit. But in terms of rural Alaska, as was mentioned, very few communities are fluoridated at this point. There is a training issue. There's also a capacity issue in terms of many of our water operators are part-time employees, and it takes a while to get the certifications that they can do fluoridation. To the point on the Hooper Bay incident, and Troy, if you want to know the from the engineering or the water system approach on that, what happened, he was with the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation at that time, so he has a lot of the information. But the fluoride content in that water was estimated at 150 parts per million. So 150 times the recommended level. One of the possible scenarios is that the way this stuff was hooked up, it created a back siphon and concentrated the fluoride in the water. So I think that in terms of fluoride, we would acknowledge that at very high doses, it is not good for you. Besides the tooth decay, when you start getting up there at that level of concentration, it can be lethal. The other one that I would mention that most people are not generally aware of is for many of us, we've had gone to the dentist or our kids have gone to the dentist, and they put on the fluoridated gel in terms of doing that. I'm aware of two deaths nationally of young children that were unattended in a dental office and swallowed too much of that gel and expired. So on any of these things or any public health approach, it doesn't mean that you just, you know, assume that everything's going to be safe. It needs to be monitored. It needs to be done right. But it, part of this resolution would acknowledge that if done right, it can reap a substantial savings in terms of dental costs. And given some of the other dynamics that work against doing water fluoridation, we'd appreciate the support. I think it's a support for the systems that choose to fluoridate. It's a support for the water operators that actually do the day-to-day work at keeping it at the right levels. And it just fits with a, sort of a little bit of a pat on the back for those that are trying to either implement fluoridation or those that are doing it now.
Thank you, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've touched a little bit, just a comment, we've touched a little bit about the safety issues on this, and I think that we recognize that, and we'll, I'm sure your department will do everything to make sure that people are trained correctly, but I know when I was running a water system that we had to do monthly samples of our water system that were sent in to an engineer, was broke down exactly what was in the water. Those were reported to the DEC. So, you know, if I'm assuming that other water systems, you know, that are in this have to follow those same regulations. If there was an overfluoridation like this, it would only last for a month. So it's not that issue, I don't think, is there. You know, this is a long-term thing. I'm correct.
They're actually doing testing far more frequently. It's reported monthly, but most of the systems are doing it daily. And so in terms of the recommendations, even if it got, you know, on that particular incident where it got as possibly as high as 150 parts per million, even if the system starts to exceed 4 parts per million at this time, it's to the point that the systems need to disconnect the fluoridation pump and stop putting fluoride in the water until they figure out what's going on. So it's in terms of just outcomes of the incident in Alaska, I think that it's made a lot more awareness. Now, that part of that means that many communities have discontinued fluoridation, but even for the water operators that are fluoridating, they're very concerned about it and they monitor it closely. And so it would not go on for a month before something happened. I think you'd see immediate action if we started to get up there at 4 parts per million or more.
Representative Sista.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of sound like a broken record, I know, but I'd love to sort of start tracking down cost. And one of those is dental emergencies. The fact that we're medevacing top dollar of all dollars is a medevac. And knowing now that in fact dental emergencies are one of the kinds, that would be fairly easy to come up with that number, you'd think, but where do I ask?
Well, I know with the Eastern Aleutian Tribes, which is where I think you got the information, they were tracking it because they were looking at their medevac services and found that the adult dental emergencies were the most frequent reasons that they were doing medevacs into Anchorage on that. It's sort of, that's an anecdotal piece. I haven't heard that from other health corporations, nor have I heard that so much from outside the Native healthcare system.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think that where I heard it from was the Lululik, is it, in Dutch Harbor, was mentioning it being one of the number one. It wasn't okay. Eastern Aleutians,
okay.
Although they could have been both of those mentioning it.
I'd like to point out we're going to lose members, so if you want to move this resolution today, we may want to stop.
No question.
Will you take that motion? I move HCR 5 with attached fiscal notes on to the next committee, which I believe is S.
With individual recommendations?
With individual recommendations.
Hearing no objections, so moved. We're adjourned.